Welcome to the Impact Nations podcast, episode 711. My name is Tim. I am your host. Today I am joined by Dad. Well, I call him Dad. You can call him Steve. And today we're actually joined by a very special guest. I'm excited to welcome Douglas Campbell. Douglas is a New Zealander, but I know he got at least some of his education up in Canada. And now he's a professor of New Testament at Duke University. Welcome, Douglas. So glad to have you.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You have, you're tied for the best haircut on this call, and you brought your sweater game today, too. That is a fantastic sweater, so I think you and I will be friends just fine.
I call it the Picard look.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Absolutely.
I didn't want to say anything, but I did notice a similarity.
God bless that man. I give thanks to him. I give thanks every day.
Amen. Douglas, you are an expert on Paul, and so we wanted to get you in as we've been talking about Ephesians, and we're kind of at the halfway point here. We've been going through Ephesians kind of verse by verse. We've covered the first three chapters, and we thought, all right, well, let's take a little break from kind of the expository work here and just zoom out a little bit and talk a little bit more about who this man Paul was who wrote this book and why he wrote this book, some of the themes that we can find overarching in the book of Ephesians and stuff like that. So I wondered if maybe you could just talk to us a little bit about your journey of discovering Paul and why you really felt like the Lord is directing you to study Paul and his writings.
Yeah. I do worry about that I've made a horrible mistake because I wandered into Richard Longnecker's class on Romans in my second year of graduate school in Toronto, and I was studying kind of theology and political theory at the time. I thought I was going to do a PhD on Hegel and Marx and Luther, and I sat in the class and I thought, I want to be that guy, and he was talking about Romans. So this entailed a very rapid change of course. I had to go and learn Greek and start swatting up on Paul. And I ended up studying with Professor Longnecker of blessed memory and writing on a little chunk of Romans. I kind of got obsessed with Paul. And I got really fired up with the questions that Longnecker was asking. And this is in the late 80s. And so Sander's book, Paul and Palestinian Judaism, had just been published. And so the discipline was really in a foment. A lot of really heavy hitters were coming out of Yale doing work on letter theory, rhetoric, people like Stanley Stowers looking at philosophers, Mal Herbie, Keck. I mean, a lot was happening. So it was a very exciting time to be studying Paul. And when I got back to New Zealand as a ostensible Paul expert, but knowing very little, I bumped into this guy, Alan Torrance, son of James Torrance, nephew of T.F. Torrance, the great ones. Brilliant theologian. Became a very good friend. And he began explaining some theological categories to me, which changed my life and changed my understanding of Paul. And they resonated with what I saw in Paul. Longnecker had taught me that the heart of Paul was participation. And I believed him. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. It's everywhere, being in Christ. You must have hit that phrase 25 times, you know, by the point you've reached in the letter. Yeah. So I was very convicted by that. And I saw in a flash that a lot of Paul scholars were on the wrong track and had kind of captured Paul's gospel in a false framework. And so I was pretty pumped up about the need to articulate what I took to be the right gospel, which I saw to be a very constructive force in the life of the church and the lives of Christians, really liberated them, set them free, gave them a sense of joy. And this false gospel, this false account of Paul, really shut that down, got in the way of it, and introduced a certain anxiety and harshness. So I had that brilliant flash of inspiration in 1991, and then I had to try and write a book about it. This took some time. It was a real struggle. eventually I gave birth to this monstrous tome and handed off the manuscript in 2007. It took Erdmans a year and a half to edit the thing, put it into print. So that was the start of the publication kind of profile. But these things have been gestating for a very long time. I haven't really changed my mind about any of that. I've remained obsessed with Paul. And another kind of strand here that's important is while I was teaching in England, in London, I was able to go and be a kind of a glorified tour guide in the locations where Paul was. And I ended up doing some TV work. So I went back to them, revisited them many times, stood on the piles of rocks where Paul was and talked about things like Philippians and the Corinthians, got to know his footsteps. And you see things when you're on the ground that you don't see when you're looking at a map in a book. So at the same time I was on this theological journey, this theological crusade, I was also on this biographical exploration. I began to see the two things were very closely intertwined. Every biography of Paul is a theology of Paul. And every theology of Paul presupposes a biography. So I began to kind of try and hold these two things together. So that became another great passion of mine. I would wake up in the morning worrying about what Paul had for breakfast and which house he stayed in and who was cleaning his laundry and stuff. I mean, it was ridiculous. But it has given me a reasonably thick understanding of what's going on.
What is the response from others? Because you talked about you've come at it, as you said, once you've seen it, you can't unsee it. And you're talking about this, what you've labeled as a participation gospel, which I think you're juxtaposing against the more kind of penal substitutionary atonement, or, you know, that focus on a judgmental God who's got to deal with your sin with punishment, so to speak. So maybe first off, just confirm whether or not I'm understanding that correctly, but also, what's been the reception as you've tried to come against that, if you will, with a different revelation?
Yeah, well, you're right on the money. Yes, that's exactly right. One of the things that I was taught, I was a convert, and one of the things I was first taught was Romans was what it was all about, and Romans 3:21-26 is what it was all about, and that's where you get the doctrine of penal substitution. I remember reading it at the time and thinking, that does seem a little vague to me. Then I did my doctoral thesis on it and came to the conclusion it just wasn't there exegetically. This was wishful thinking. Didn't really know what to do with that at the time, but I think I do now. So yeah, you're exactly right. Pushing back on a retributive understanding of Paul's gospel. What's the reception been like? Oh, fairly hostile.
Heard that before.
Fairly hostile, somewhat dismissive, cowardly. In the sense, I'm happy to debate with this with anyone, anywhere, anytime, but I just tend not to be invited to stuff. Yeah. That's, you know, whatever. Having said that, I do have fellow companions on the road. Folks that are really kind of see things the way I do. Definitely a minority, but I believe the future belongs to us. We will win. Yeah. Gandhi said once, first they ignore you, then they mock you, then they fight you, and then you win. So hopefully you guys are helping me to make the transition from mockery to fighting. Is that right? Is that where we are?
Well, that's where we're at,
I think. That's certainly where we are. And even our mission. Yeah. Even in our world, I think it's inevitable. I think that the things that were just assumed, that were taught to me when I first came to Christ in my 20s, that essentially God's angry and he sent Jesus, and aren't we lucky? Because otherwise...
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And that is, obviously, we know, still a majority view, but it's crumbling quickly, I think.
I wonder, at the risk of getting too far away from Ephesians, you mentioned Romans 3 and that kind of being the anchor for a more retributive understanding of God. Can you break that down a little bit in terms of how we should be interpreting those passages versus how how they are very often interpreted?
Yeah, yeah. I'm just finishing a co-authored book on this called Beyond Justification with my great friend, former student, John DePew. And we get into this a bit. And then I'm supposed to write a commentary for Erdmann's after that, which I will get into this. And I've just been talking about it, actually, at a conference in St. Andrews, and I'll be doing it again in Korea. So this is very much on my mind. And that paragraph is what the Rattles called a partitio. It's a pointing paragraph. It's often been read as a thesis paragraph that responds to a problem that's been set up in 118 through 320. Mm-hmm. I would argue that the notion or the supposition that Paul is laying out his own views in Romans 118 to 320 is very problematic. There's a lot of problems that it doesn't really know how to solve. One of the best reasons for that is Ephesians. You can't really read Ephesians and then go, oh, yeah, that's the guy. He thinks like Romans 118 to 320. Like, these things just don't add up. And I dare say we'll be talking about that. So let's just take 118 to 320 off the table, do something different with that. And when you do that, you suddenly see that Romans 3:21 to 26 is kind of very compact, but it's pointing to ahead to three strong, extensive arguments that Paul is going to make in the rest of the letter through the end of chapter 8. It's going to talk about Abraham as an example from the Torah of the faithfulness of Christ and our faith in him. And that justifies Paul saying that the Torah, not all the other scriptures, but the actual Pentateuch, anticipates his gospel. And then 3:23 to 24 points ahead to the solution that Paul is going to give us to sin, which is participation in the death and resurrection of Christ. It's a baptismal account and a liberative account. And he will talk about that in detail from 5:12 through about 8:14. And then 3:25 to 26 points ahead to a related issue, which is what sort of God are we going to meet at the end of the age? As you just said, precisely, is this God angry with us? Is he going to crush us, maim us, torture us, whatever, banish us? Because the Roman Christians are being frightened by interlopers who are preaching this kind of turn or burn gospel. Hmm. And Paul says, well, what sort of God do we know about? Well, if we just look at participation in baptism and a God who will offer up his only son to die for us while we are still hostile, while we are spitting in the face of this God, rejecting this God, this child is offered up to die for us. What sort of God do we see there? And Paul is emphatically clear, a God of limitless love, limitless, unbounded compassion and benevolence that will stop at nothing to connect with us. That's the doctrine of God that Paul gives us. So Romans 3:21 to 26 is pointing to some pretty important stuff.
Yeah.
And when we fit all that together, as you know, well, you kind of end up with Ephesians.
So, what's the level of opposition, or what's the nature of the opposition regarding your argument for Romans 1:18 through 3:20? In terms of, like you said, let's just set that aside for a moment. Right. What's your justification for setting that aside, and where's the opposition to that at?
Well, the opposition probably comes first, and the opposition is this is where people ground Paul's gospel. So they want to read Romans. There's a very old tradition of reading Romans as Paul's systematic theological statement. Mm-hmm. And I'm anticipating one of our exchanges we'll have probably shortly is I actually think that's very wrong. I think Romans is very circumstantial, targeting practical local problems in Rome. Ephesians is Paul's systematic theology. I've got reasons for saying that. I have to give a practical, circumstantial reason for saying Ephesians is Paul's systematic theology, and my opponents have to give a practical, circumstantial reason for saying that Romans is Paul's systematic theology, and they can't. But what I'm what clues us in to the issues in Romans 1:18 to 3:20 not being Paul's account of systematic theology is there's a lot of issues, but let me dial in on a couple. Mm-hmm. One is the construction of the Jew there is very harsh, very unfair, and very inconsistent with what Paul says about Israel later in the letter.
Mm-hmm.
So the construction of the Jew in Romans 2, very legalistic, very individualistic. You earn your way to heaven. And Paul doesn't really talk about Jews like that elsewhere. And he doesn't talk about individuals. He talks about the nation, and he talks about God calling it into existence. So there's a real tension there. And there's a very retributive God there who collides with the God of love that we were just talking about, who is at the heart of the argument in Romans 5 and 8. So what do you do with that? And you get to Romans 5, and commentators do what they always do, is they just keep reading and saying, oh, you know, Paul's going to talk about love. And you're sitting there going, okay, let's think about this like a theologian. We've got a major problem here. Sort it out for me. And they don't.
Yeah.
They just stay with what they've got, and we end up confused or nasty or both. So the Jew's off, the picture of God is off, and the form of knowledge is off. Romans 1 starts off with natural theology, and you have this philosophical encounter with God, and you figure out that God hates you and has a terrible plan for your life and is going to judge you if you step out of line. Just put that next to 1 Corinthians 1, where Paul says God has confounded both the Jew and the Greek, the scholar and the sage, through the revelation of his nature through the cross, which we apprehend by the Spirit, which is very specialized, particular, through preaching, through the church, completely unanticipatable, that we would go, oh, yeah, God, look, God is revealed definitively by this naked, crucified man being tortured to death. Yeah, that makes perfect sense, right? That makes no sense at all, but that's the heart of the gospel.
Right.
And that's 1 Corinthians and everything else that Paul wrote, but not Romans 1. What has happened? Is Paul having a bad day? Has he suddenly flipped and gone, gee, all that stuff about the cross, terrible mistake. Let's start somewhere else. No, of course he hasn't. We're just reading it wrong. But you know that famous saying about lobbyists? It's really hard to convince a person of the truth of a position when them keeping their job depends on them not understanding it. This is where we're at, right?
Yeah.
In this debate, this is where we're at.
So, I have two follow-up questions. We will get to Ephesians, I promise, but this is helpful groundwork. We have, in these very chairs, spoken about Romans 1:18 and following, where it's talking about God's wrath and God's anger, broken that down to say, look, if you look carefully, what it's saying is God's wrath is actually his divine consent. You know, Romans 1:18 starts with God's anger, and then very quickly into 24, verse 24, God abandoned them to whatever they desired to do. What do you think about that argument is question number one? And question number two is, okay, so if this isn't Paul's thinking, I'm assuming that you're positing that this is effectively a diatribe. Like this is Paul setting up a straw man or a counter argument so that he can therefore counter it as he's approaching the close of chapter three. Am I understanding that correct?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah, Socratic. If you want to have a Socratic argument with someone and they're not in the room, you've got to present their position before you nail it. And you want to nail it in terms of its own assumptions.
Yeah.
So I think this is a little capsule summary of this opposing group that he's anticipating arriving in Rome. And what I would want to emphasize about this opposing group is their sincerity. And the fact that they're part of the early church, they're messianic Jews, these guys. Mm-hmm. They follow Jesus. But they're kind of traditionalists. And like all religious traditionalists in the history of the church, they can't handle the changes that Paul is saying they need to take on board. And they're managing Christian ethics the way, again, a lot of people do it. They're trying to intimidate their converts, frighten them. Into behaving in the right way. And you and I know that this mentality is ubiquitous. in the church. Yeah. And Paul is, these guys are Pelagians. You know, if you're going to frighten people into behaving well, you got to be a Pelagian, because the assumption is that they can actually do what they need to do and get on with it. And Paul's Augustinian. He's tried this, and he knows that he just does not have the resources within him as a human being to act rightly. And even his attempts to act rightly turn out to be fundamentally misguided. So this is his real problem with them. So he turns on them at the start of chapter 2. You who are judging others, you've got some issues you need to sort out as well. Don't you believe that God is going to judge everybody by their works? Well, haven't you just eliminated your own missionary program? Because if they can just look at God and do the right thing, they don't need to join up with your program and become a Jew to get saved. They can just work away on their own and do it. Oh, yeah, hadn't thought of that, Paul. Good point. Does it really matter, in fact, if you're a Jew anymore, according to your gospel? You really care about Jews in Israel, but according to your program, they're completely irrelevant. Oh, yeah, good point, Paul. What about what the Bible says? What about what the Bible says everywhere about every single facet of our being grounded in sin and incapacity? What are you going to do with that? Nobody gets saved this way, not even you. Oh, yes, excellent point, Paul. Yes, time to rethink. And then you're ready, you know?
Yeah.
So I think this is what's going on. I think it's Socratic. And I don't know, you know, I don't want to be a jerk or anything, but I don't know of any serious problems, exegetical or interpretive, with the Socratic reading. All I know of is objections that 2 minutes of thinking reveal are invalid. For example, how would the Romans have known that Paul was acting Socratically if he didn't tell them? What do you think of that objection?
I was going to ask, in terms of, you know, I don't read Greek and I don't understand the, I don't know, the formatting. I'm thinking, you know, if this was formatted on a modern PC or whatever, you'd have maybe an indent and in italics or something like that. We'd be able to see that. And I don't know how, did Paul use a different color ink or what?
Well, how does he send his letter? How does it go from him to the Roman Christians?
Gets delivered by hand and then read by someone who was delivering it.
That's right. Yeah, it gets read out. And where did that person get taught how to read the letter?
Mm.
Where was it first read? Well, it was read in Corinth, where it was performed. And then you go to Rome and it gets performed. And ancient letter theorists talk about the importance of performing a letter. Yeah. So it really is like a play. And Quintilian says, when you're using this opening technique, which he calls prosopopoeia, mask wearing, or speech and character, when you're doing this technique, don't overdo it like a comic actor. Be a little more subtle, which is lovely, isn't it? Don't overact when you're in the persona of somebody else. You know, don't ham it up or you'll lose the effect. Do a good acting performance, which means, of course, they act it. And all the school kids were taught this technique in school. This is how they learned to write good Greek and good Latin. They would imitate somebody from old and write a speech and put it in their mouth. So it's very, very widespread. So if the Roman Christians are sitting at the end of chapter 3 and going, what the hell is going on here, Phoebe? She goes, well, I've had this conversation with Paul. Let me tell you. This is Socratic, boys. Okay, other people are going to forget this, but you've got me in the room and I can help you out. All right. And away you go. You remember the Colbert Report?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, of course. Did he ever tell you
that
he was spoofing a right-wing host?
No.
I know some people thought he was a genuine right-wing tyro.
Wow, but that's a problem.
But he wasn't, right?
Right.
But he was. Why did he not have to tell you?
Because it was so over the top, and we just knew. I don't know.
Yeah. You knew it was over the top, and it was funny, right?
Yeah.
But he never told you.
Yeah.
2,000 years from now, historians from Alpha Centauri will have trouble working out that he's a spoof.
Yeah.
Right?
That's a good point.
But we know it. It's just damn obvious. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. So anyway, that's the sort of debate that I have with folks, and I think I'm right.
Imagine that.
I think I'm right. And I think I'm right because if you deal with Romans 1-3 in the kind of usual reading, the rest of Paul just clicks into place. You know, suddenly Ephesians is something that talks about Paul. Talks the way you would expect Paul to talk. Starts the way you would expect Paul to start, right?
Mm.
So this is where I'm going.
Yeah. All right. So I want to pivot now into Ephesians and talk about this idea of Ephesians is Paul's systematic theology. That's really interesting. But before I do, I just want to pause real quick for an ad. Just if you're new to the podcast or you've been around for a long time, you know that Impact Nations is in the business of rescuing lives. We like to say we rescue lives with a really big gospel. This beautiful gospel that Paul wrote about and preached all over the place, we still believe it to this day. We believe that the gospel is big enough and powerful enough to transform every part of life. And that's what motivates us at Impact Nations to go and do what we do, to go and rescue people from horrific, dangerous situations. And we're talking about children being rescued from slavery in factories in Asia. We're talking about women being rescued from brothels, from forced prostitution, teenage girls being rescued from having been abused and abandoned, tossed out on the street and left with no recourse, pregnant and alone. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. As you may know, we are in the middle of our annual Survive to Thrive campaign. And Survive to Thrive is all about rescuing these teen moms, these young women, and I'm talking like as young as 12 years old, who have been impregnated at the hands of an abuser, are alone, without hope, have no idea what's going to come next for them. And our team comes along and brings them hope. And they scoop them up, they bring them into shelter, provide for their medical needs. Throughout their pregnancy, you can imagine these young girls, it's very dangerous to actually be carrying a baby at that age. And so the Impact Nations family is able to meet their medical needs. We counsel them throughout the process, provide them shelter. And then, by the way, eventually, once their baby is born and they're ready to move on, by that point, we are training them in skills in business, giving them very marketable skills so they can go and either start their own business with some other girls in their situation or go and find employment. But all of that work is so vitally, vitally important, and we rescue hundreds and hundreds of lives. I mean, honestly, we impact thousands of lives in this one particular ministry every single year. But it can't be done without the Impact Nations family. So if you're listening to this, I would encourage you, head to impactnations.com/thrive. Do a little bit of reading. It's a short web page. There's a few videos of some testimonies of young women who have been rescued through this program and have found restoration in Christ. And it is so beautiful to see these stories and these young women telling their story and actually talking about how they discovered forgiveness. They discovered how to forgive their abusers, how to forgive their family who abandoned them and shamed them. And they found forgiveness in their heart because of the work that Christ has done within them. And all of that happens because somebody like you gave and empowered us to go and rescue these young girls. So we would encourage you, please participate with us. We're leading up to Mother's Day. We always surround this around Mother's Day because honestly, the Impact Nations family, your heroes, but really the true heroes are these young women who are overcoming these awful circumstances, and they just continue to bravely take one step ahead of another. And so we want to honor these young moms during Mother's Day by rescuing more and more of them. So please help bring rescue and restoration in Uganda for these young teen moms. You can do that at impactnations.com/thrive.
Great.
All right, Ephesians.
Yes.
Douglas and I are having a great conversation. Do you want to join us?
I went and got a coffee. Nobody noticed. Douglas, before we get into the, and I love Ephesians. I love especially chapters 1-3. The theology. I just love it. But As I usually do, as I do a series, I did background work. I taught them background stuff on what was going on in Ephesus, the imperial cult, and Artemis, and on and on. In all of the reading I did, and for this series, I've read a lot of books. When we came to dating it, Almost everybody said that Paul wrote this in the late 50s to early 60s when he was in his Roman prisoner. A few said no, it was earlier when he was a prisoner before he went to Rome. But all of it was dated usually early 60s or late 50s. And then I came across you just
some
a few
crazy
weeks
dude
ago
in a sweater.
And I went, what? And would you explain your position and the why, and why it matters? Because when I read that, I thought that really matters a lot, the dating.
Yeah, great question. More than one question in there. Thank you. You're exactly right. I am a little different. A couple of things going on here. One is the, I think, unfair marginalization of Ephesians from Paul by Protestant scholars who fear its endorsement of Catholicism and its lack of emphasis on construct that we've been batting around and targeting, things like penal substitution and justification.
Mm-hmm.
And as you well know, Ephesians talks about justification for three verses in passing, which is about what it merits, in my view, correctly understood, because justification is not the heart of Paul's thinking. It's a very kind of contingent circumstantial doctrine. So if you're breaking away from that anyway and saying, well, maybe justification isn't what Paul's about, you don't have the Catholic hang-up when you come to Ephesians. You could be like, oh, gosh, this is participatory. Maybe Paul really cared about the church a lot more than we thought he did. Shucks, imagine that. So if you can push that theological prejudice to one side, you begin to understand how dubious most of the dating schemes are, because those that want to hang on to Ephesians and say it's authentic try to save it by saying, well, I guess Paul matured, you know, he was like an old guy like me and he'd mellowed and got nice, and instead of all the savagery that we see in Romans and Galatians, he's like looking down, looking back on a life when the church is happy and unified. And I think that makes absolutely no sense at all. All we see in those big letters is fracture and conflict and attack. But what we do see is a process of attempted reconciliation, which actually got off to a good start. Paul tells us in Galatians, he journeys to Jerusalem. There's a big conference. His controversial gospel is aired out, and they all shake hands.
Mm-hmm.
And they all go, this is great. We can all get on the same page here. You do it your way, we'll do it our way. And isn't that great? God is in this. And the wheels fall off that agreement not long afterwards, probably about a year and a half. There's backsliding and betrayal. Gee, who would have thought that Christians would have behaved like that? So I go, if this text is authentic, it really needs to fall into this window when Paul is looking back on a conference and saying, hey, the church, we're all together. We are one. And we're all doing this work together. So I go, well, when and how could this work? And here we bring in the next kind of important related issue. Ephesians and Colossians have to be written at the same time.
I agree.
Yeah. And if Colossians is first, then Ephesians is fake. But if Ephesians is first, then we can understand Colossians as somebody under pressure suddenly dashing off a letter to address something specific on the basis of a crafted treatise. What's wrong with that theory? There's nothing wrong with that theory. And look at the way Ephesians ends and Colossians ends. These letters almost belong together like a unit. And so let's read the end of Colossians and see what's going on. Oh, what do you know? There's some other letter here. He's written some letter to Laodicea. And he's sending it off with Colossians, and they need to copy and read Laodiceans, and Colossians needs to be copied and sent on. These letters are going off at the same time, along with Philemon, from which we get this information, they're close by what they're writing to. They have to be close by. And Paul wrote a letter to Laodicea, which he wrote first. What's the situation in Laodicea? They don't know him. These are people that have converted. They're pagans who have converted. They're within Paul's remit, but he doesn't know them. And he's in jail. He's going to get tried. Some Roman official is going to look at him and say, are you worth worrying about, or am I just going to deal with you right now and kill you? He may lose his life any moment. So what do you do when you're about to face death? You've got these converts down the road. They don't know anything about you. You write down the heart of it all. You write down your theology and say, this is what you are involved with, brothers and sisters. In other words, you compose in the dark of a jail which stinks and is rat-infested, where you're locked into stocks, probably covered in excrement. You compose in that place that theological essay that you really want to give people as your last will and testament, if that's what it is, which spells out what you think about God's gift and calling on your life. And you stick it in a letter, and you've just finished it when you get news that something else is happening in Colossae. You do have a connection there. The wheels are falling off. So you write a letter to them, and you've got this really unhappy, beaten, broken slave boy whom you've converted, and you're desperate to send him back and repair that relationship. So you write to Philemon. You package up those letters and send them off down the road. And what you end up with is a letter written to Laodicea. And how did the Laodicean church work out? In the Bible. How did it go?
If you like lukewarm, they're your flagship.
Yeah, you guys are pretty much
vomit-inducing.
The last. Yeah. You're the worst. Out of seven churches, you're bottom, okay? And what's top? Well, that would be Ephesians. Yes. Ephesians is top. So you can see some scribe going, oh, no, this is a complete catastrophe. We can't have Paul sending his final will and testament to Laodicea. Let's just scratch that out and give him the benefit of the doubt. So it goes, disappears. And then 300 years later, you've got scribes going, well, we need something here. There is a gap. What are we going to do? Oh, well, you know, Ephesus is a good church. People talk about that a lot in the Bible. I'll stick that in the margin. You can see it. You can see the manuscripts with the blanks and it written in the margins. And yeah. So we end up with it in Ephesus. I think probably that, I don't want to upset you, but I think if this letter was written in Ephesus, it's not authentic. But it doesn't have to be.
And I think when would you date that letter? It probably matters to me more than 50. The listeners.
50. Yeah.
The really early. So write, like I, okay. I was about to go down another track of Galatians versus First Thessalonians, but so is it post Galatians?
No. Galatians is the following year.
Okay.
He just had a conference. He's had the big conference in Jerusalem,
right?
Which Galatians talks about.
Yeah.
And Acts talks about this. He's making his way from Galatia, from Pisidian Antioch near modern Yalvach in Turkey. He's tracking west, and instead of what he did the first time and heading north, he's heading down into the valley, the Lycus Valley, beautiful big plain there, and Hierapolis is still there, Pamukkale it's called now. And he's coming down in there, and someone's detained him at the border and interrogated him because he's always causing trouble wherever he goes. And he composes this letter about the pagans that are ahead of him. And Acts is close to this. You might recall when Paul is going through the inland route, he meets a group of people that have a kind of an inadequate Christian discipleship. They only know the baptism of John.
Yes.
If you read the Greek carefully, although that story wants to look, you feel like it's in Ephesus. You actually don't need to read the Greek that way. He's on his way to Ephesus, and he meets this group of disciples. And I think the author of Acts knows exactly what's going on. I think this is a little hint about what happened on that trip. Paul did meet a group of people who didn't really understand the gospel fully, and Ephesians was written into that space. Yeah. So he survived. He comes down. He goes to Ephesus, and that's when the Ephesian ministry starts. And as you know, it was very dramatic and very important, very significant, and also very, very overwhelming. Things went wrong. And it's while he's in Ephesus and starting to travel back around and he's collecting money for the church, the wheels start to fall off. People start to come through who are rivals and opposition. And he realizes that the church is actually pretty fractured. He's got to start opposing these guys. So the year of conflict, 51, follows a year of ecumenicity, an ecumenical year, which is the year of 50. Probably one of the happiest years of his life, apart from the fact he's in jail for part of it.
Right.
Yeah. Probably one of that's the last happy time for Paul. After that, it's just conflict and jail.
Yeah. So I, you know, for our listeners who, at least I'm fascinated by this stuff, but I'm sure some are like, okay, dates, I don't know, whatever. I've got my Bible in front of me. I'm sitting down to Ephesians. Why does it matter to me whether it was written in 50 or years later? How does this apply to those who just want to sit down and read what Paul had to say?
Yeah, great question, and entirely fair. In some respects, you don't have to worry about it too much unless you're very attached to the idea that Paul wrote this, and then you have to get down and dirty in some of the debates, and scholars have got reasons flying around. And so what I'm trying to do is say, I think we can have confidence that this really is by Paul. The second thing is, I think the bit of the circumstance that I'm suggesting that's significant is rather than marginalizing this letter and making it very late, somewhat senile, or just saying it's not by Paul at all, it's been faked, this account that I'm giving puts it right in the middle of his work, right in the middle. It's like the hub of the wheel. And not a lot of people read it that way. But I would encourage you to read it that way. Read Ephesians the way most people want to read Romans.
Very good.
Seriously.
Yeah.
If someone says, hey, let's read what Paul has to say, what's his theology, where does it start with Ephesians 1:1?
Start with
and the then theory. Start with the Berakah, with the blessing.
Yeah.
That's where Paul starts. He's quite Calvinist, isn't he? In a good way, like a Bardian Calvinist. Because he starts off with... He doesn't start off with you and me on our journey to find God. He doesn't start off with sinners in the hands of an angry God. He starts off with a God who loves you from before the foundation of the world. And
chose you.
To create you.
Yeah.
Right? How good is that?
Yeah.
That's good news, right? That's where you start the story. Time. That's the theological story starts there. Yeah.
Hey, can I ask you a question? I don't mean to take over, but I got some of these things. I've spent months and months in Ephesians. And, you know, I've got way too many books. I'm sure I'm OCD about it. But one of the biggest, most exciting themes for me, because it's personally been a theme in my life the last 10, 12 years, is the mystery of Christ. You know, I've said in the podcast several times, Paul is a mystic. If we don't understand the mystical side of him, we don't understand Paul. And, you know, that and talking about the Spirit, and we can talk about that in a few minutes, but would you mind just talking a little bit about that key word of mystery that comes
with great
up,
pleasure.
I think yes. Seven times. Thank you.
Yeah, with great pleasure, which is kind of an Ephesian motif, isn't it? Mysterion, one of the most brilliant students I ever taught, who's now a senior lecturer in New Testament at St. Andrews, T.J. Lang, wrote his doctoral dissertation on this.
Really?
And you will like what he found, because he found that the church fathers zeroed in on this and made it one of the keys to their entire theological program and to their entire biblical program, the Mysterion. And if we press into the lexicography of Mysterion, what we find is it refers to a secret that a divinity is holding closely, which is then revealed at the proper time to that divinity's chosen followers. So Paul is not talking about something that is inaccessible or unknown. He's doing the opposite. He's saying, oh, we know, but we only know because God has actually told us this and revealed it by his Spirit to his chosen emissaries, of whom I happen to be one. So let me tell you about the secret that lies at the heart of the cosmos and that lies at the heart of the scriptures. So the church fathers loved this because they could go all through the Bible and track through the Bible and read it in wonderfully creative and liberating ways, because the secret that it's always meant to be talking about is Jesus. He is the one through whom all things were created and for whom all things were created. So you get this lovely Jesus-centered exposition of the Bible with compassion flowing and inclusion flowing, you know, which is so obvious in your wonderful ministry. You kind of sense the compassion flowing, the compassion of Christ to reach out and care and nurture and include. So it's a critical term. You're exactly right. You're exactly right. And it fits in very neatly to everything else that's really going on. It's kind of the key where, as Kierkegaard said, we're apostles. We're not sages. We're not philosophers. We don't figure this out for ourselves. We're humble people who've been given this priceless gift of knowledge into the workings of God. And you get on with it and proclaim it and act it out and go where you're meant to go and tell people the good news. All right. You didn't earn this. You can't boast about it, but ain't it great that we've got it? Yeah. That's great. So I hope that helps a little bit.
That's really great. Can I just throw in a little other one? I love the church fathers, and I love what you articulated so clearly, that mysterion is this knowledge, this revelation that God gives us. We can't figure it out. Is it right for me to say that one of Paul's passions was to express this as articulately as he could, as opposed to Gnostics who say we have this hidden knowledge?
I'm glad you asked that. I was going to ask that very same question.
do you understand what I'm saying? Because I think Gnosticism never goes away. I think that we still fight it in the 21st century.
Yeah. Well, I'm often accused of being a Gnostic, which always makes me giggle. You know, the Gnostics, the problem with the Gnostics is they don't fully understand what the secret is. Mm-hmm. I think the basic structure of what's going on is fine. They kind of get the revelatory bit and people get revealed this, and it's like, yeah, it's a revelation. You got to kind of join the club. But the secret that Paul gets revealed is that you are in Christ.
Yes.
You're already seated in the heavenly realms. And again, Gnostics kind of get this. There's a kind of transcendent move here. God has acted decisively and anticipated a coming shift in the ages, like a vast shift in the ages, when all that we are that is kind of corrupt and broken will cease and will be recreated and reconstituted and lifted into this new age. And this is already breaking in on us. What the Gnostics get, I would suggest, they get the transcendence, and they forget that God's transcendence is worked out as demonstrated by the cross in the dirty, dark corners of our bodily existence. You can't escape that, and you can't negate that. That's where it's happening. You don't get rid of your body. You don't get rid of your details. That's where God is at work. And as soon as you start to say, well, you know, we can just forget about certain zones of existence, we can forget about our bodies or whatever, you lose it. You lose the whole kind of ethical impact. You lose the sort of work that you guys are doing. All right, if you're a Gnostic, who really cares what's happening to the bodies of these girls? Right? They can transcend them. They can leave them in their minds and spirit. It doesn't really matter. We can treat it like it's like, who really gives a damn? It doesn't matter. None of that stuff matters.
Yes.
Because we can escape, you know, with our spirit into the world of light and leave it all behind. Wrong. The world of light is pressing into these bodies, and what happens to these bodies is incredibly important. they're being hurt and harmed and broken, and this is where God wants us to get to work, restoring and healing.
Yeah.
So that, you see what I'm...
You know, absolutely, I do. Yeah. Absolutely, I do. Yeah. And that's why we're just making the shift now, the therefore shift of 4-1, we get into now, because of this truth, this is how we walk it out. And yet, I remember once we were feeding starving people, tens of thousands, and somebody said to me, well, why bother feeding them? They're just going to get hungry again. To me, that's an extension of what you're talking about.
That's a Gnostic.
Yeah. It's a Gnostic.
That's
right?
A Gnostic.
Because all we need to do is get them to pray the prayer, and then they'll be in heaven.
You know? Exactly. And that, you know, it's a great point you're making. The kind of penal substitutionary gospel encourages functional Gnosticism.
Yes, it does.
Because it tells you, you know, confess with your mouth and that's it. You know, information download, get on with your life. Who cares? Yeah, so wrong. God is pressing into every part of us.
Yes.
Every detail. Loves every detail and wants it to be healed and redeemed and recapitulated. Lifted up. Right? Anencephalosis of chapter one. This is where it's all going.
Creating. So can I keep throwing these themes at you?
I actually have to plug. I've just noticed the power cord is detached from my computer, and we are about to.
You want
to
take a plug-in moment?
I am. I'm just gonna. We'll take. Do that. Apologize.
All right. I tell you what. While Douglas is charging his computer, let me take this opportunity to say, let's make this a two-episode thing. We've got so much material here, and I know there's a lot more to come. So we're going to take this opportunity we'll keep rolling, and we'll keep the conversation going, but we'll see you next week, and we'll pick this up right away.